Hey, great. Well, thank you guys for having me. It's nice to be back in California. I've been working since 2012 with Dr. Yanni Huang in a new institute at Peking University called the Biodynamic Optical Imaging Center. And it's sort of this, we call it BioPIC for short, and it's sort of this interdisciplinary institute that brings biologists and chemists and physicists and computer scientists, engineers together to study biological questions. And so there's been a large effort devoted to studying biological systems at the single-cell level at BioPIC. And so I'll tell you in this presentation about some work I've been doing over the past 3 years to study using gene expression analysis, quantitative imaging, and microfluidics to study single cells. And so because I assume we have an interdisciplinary audience, it'll be, I'll sort of assume, scientist, non-expert, and kind of explain both the microfluidics and the biology. So I apologize if something's easier, you already know it, but I'm sure that I will get through it. So as a general overview, I'm going to show you how I've recently combined a pipeline for next-generation sequencing with label-free nonlinear optical microscopy, stimulated Raman scatter microscopy, on a microfluidic platform so that we can perform single-cell analysis. And the main idea of the work is that the microfluidic platform allows me to make both of these measurements on the same cell. And so in doing so, we can collect data that would be harder to collect in a traditional benchtop format. And so hopefully we can learn something new about biology. So jumping right in, the devices that I make are made out of PDMS, which is a transparent, flexible polymer. And the devices that we use incorporate the microfluidic valve, which is essentially two microfluidic channels that are about tens to hundreds of microns wide. The valve consists of a control channel that overlaps a flow channel. And so because these two valves are separated by a thin PDMS membrane, when the control channel is pressurized, it inflates and then closes off the flow channel beneath it. So the flow channels are the channels that carry all the biological reagents in the single cells. And so in this way, I can make a valve. So the microfluidic valve is very similar to the transistor in an integrated circuit. A transistor is a three-terminal electronic component on which a control voltage on one terminal can modulate the current through the other two terminals. And in that way, a microfluidic valve is basically the same, except for we have a control pressure on one terminal that can modulate the fluidic current between the other two terminals. And so in the same way that a transistor has enabled the electronic microprocessor, the microfluidic valve enables us to make electronic, or rather, microfluidic processors. So in my PhD with Steve Quick, I used these integrated microfluidic circuits, and I took advantage of the unique fluid physics, at the micro scale, to study phase transitions in biological macromolecules. And so, for example, because of the low Grashof number in microchambers, I was able to measure and manipulate protein crystal growth in a very controlled fashion. And in another experiment with Dr. Shimon Weiss at UCLA, I used this microfluidic mixing ring to automatically titrate through combinatorial mixtures of biological reagents so that we could perform single-molecule measurements on the conformational dynamics of single-stranded DNA. So we used this mixing ring to sort through a vast and multidimensional chemical space and probe how the single-stranded DNA would react, in different ionic concentrations and so forth. And in another experiment, we used a small interaction length inside the microfluidic chambers to perform very low-noise dynamic light scattering measurements on the aggregation of the Huntington protein as it converted into amyloid fibrils. And so amyloid fibrils are the toxic species associated with neurodegeneration and diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Huntington's. And so in Peking, I've been using similar systems to study biological systems. And so to back up, when we're studying any kind of system, for that matter, it's very important to understand the properties of the components of the system. And so, if an electrical engineer is studying a circuit, she can measure an input voltage, an input signal, and an output signal. And by knowing the electronic properties of the components, the transistors and the resistors and the diodes, she can model the system and reverse engineer the circuit. And so bioengineers and biophysicists are trying to do the same thing with biological systems. In order to do that, we need to understand the biological properties of the fundamental unit of our system, which is a cell. So this is where single cell measurements become very important. Let's say you're trying to characterize some property of a rare cell, like a cancer stem cell or a circulating tumor cell. If you make an ensemble measurement of some property of interest, then that measurement will give you a mean value that won't only miss the rare cell of interest, but might bias the population measurement. The same is true if you're measuring, let's say, a population of cells that exhibit a bimodal distribution in, say, the expression of a specific gene. And a mean value will give you, an ensemble measurement will give you a mean value that's not representative of either of the populations. And so in such situations, it's very useful to make many measurements on single cells so that you can reconstruct the whole population. So this is, there's many different ways of characterizing the identity of single cells. Recent developments in high-throughput sequencing have allowed us to measure the whole transcriptome of single cells. And what this gives us is the thousands of gene expression parameters that we can plug back into statistical clustering algorithms that can group cells by their gene expression profile. And we can do this without prior annotation of the cell type. And this is very important because in many situations, we don't know all of the types that are present in the biological sample that we're looking at. Of course, the oldest and maybe still one of the most powerful ways of characterizing cells is by looking at them through microscopes. But since the days of sort of qualitatively analyzing cells through using bright field, we can actually now, you know, extract quantitative information from single cells using various types of microscopy. So in this talk, what I want to show you is how I do both. Essentially, I want to take a picture of a single cell with a microscope and then measure its transcriptome of that same cell so that I make connections about the morphology of that cell and the gene expression profile of that specific cell. And the idea is that I can do this on make both of these measurements on the same cell using the advantages of microfluidic platforms. So there's a handful of different ways of measuring the transcriptome of a single cell. Here are some protocols for single cell amplification and measurement of all the RNA. And each one of these protocols that have been reported have their own unique advantages and disadvantages. Right now, the commercial standard is SmartSeq and its improved derivatives. But at BioPIC in Beijing, we were fortunate enough to be right next door to Dr. Fuchou Tang, who's one of the early developers of the single-cell RNA-seq protocols. And so in these experiments, I've used a modified version of his original protocol in a chip platform to measure the total RNA transcripts of the single cell. So here's a schematic of how I'm implementing that protocol into a chip format. Right here is a single module of my device, and this module is repeated 10 times on a chip, so I can process 10 single cells in parallel. Right here, what you're looking at in this diagram is these pink channels are the flow channels, which carry the single cells and the biological reagents. And these blue channels are the microfluidic valves. And so, one by one, I catch single cells in this trapping chamber and then direct them to the sorting chamber using the microfluidic valve. And again, the size of the channels and the valves, because they're similar to the size of cells, make it very easy to perform single cell manipulation on chip. And so, in the first step, I'll push the cell into this lysis chamber with a lysis buffer that contains primers to capture all of the poly A-tailed mRNA immediately after cell lysis. And so after cell lysis, I push then the lysate into this next chamber with a cocktail of oligos and polymerase in order to perform reverse transcription, which converts all of the poly A-tailed mRNA into single-stranded cDNA or complementary DNA. Then in this third step, I use an exonuclease to remove all of the redundant primers from the first step, and this prevents bias in downstream amplification steps. And then finally, I tail the cDNA and prime it for second-strand synthesis in this last chamber so that the result is stable double-stranded cDNA, which is representative of the original population of all of the poly-A-tailed mRNA in the cell at the time of lysis. And so each one of these chambers requires its own temporal temperature profile. And so this whole experiment is conducted on a temperature control platform. And so I can, you know, thermocycle through on each step. And so after all of these five steps, I can then flush the whole chamber with water and collect the cDNA into individual tubes for each cell. And so then after another couple steps of amplification in a tube, we then prepare the libraries for sequencing. And so by putting each one of these CDNA libraries onto a high-throughput sequencer, the output is a digital read count of all of the RNA transcripts that, when mapped back to the original genome, can be used to make gene expression measurements. Do you have a question, Mark?
Just a technical one.
Yeah.
So on the very front end, the loading end, are there some sort of optical feedback?
This is done actively. I'll show you a little movie later, but essentially I watch through a stereo microscope and catch the cell as I see it come into the trapping chamber. So it's an active trapping process. So the result of all this is sort of estimates of gene expressions for all of the RNA transcripts that you're able to capture. So the first thing that I wanted to do after developing this technology was to characterize the performance of this technique. And so we sequenced many mouse embryonic stem cells, which have relatively well-characterized gene expression profiles. And our collaborator, Dr. Tong, has sequenced many mouse embryonic stem cells using his protocol in a tube format. So we thought this would be a good system to benchmark both the sensitivity and the precision of this technique. So here's an overview of the original experiment. In all, I sequenced 56 mouse embryonic stem cells and 6 mouse embryonic fibroblasts. And then we also sequenced an extensive set of technical replicates. So a technical replicate is where I extract RNA from a bulk population of single cells and then dilute that RNA back down to single cell levels. And so each one of these technical replicates technically has essentially the same population of RNA. And so by measuring these replicates, I can remove biological variation and then directly measure the systematic variation of the technique. So this is very useful for characterizing precision and reproducibility. So you can see here, this what I'm plotting in the heat map is the global transcriptome correlation score. So you can see, for example, that the embryonic fibroblasts have form a sort of a unique group. The X and the Y axis are just the same samples. And then in the embryonic stem cell population, you can see that the technical replicates have specifically much higher correlation because there's presumably no biological variation. So first, to look at sensitivity, we're measuring gene expression using RPKM, which is a reads per kilobase transcript per million. And RPKM is a sort of a relative normalized gene expression estimate. And so here I'm saying that a gene is detected if it has an RPKM of greater than 1. And so in this bar graph here, I'm plotting the total number of genes detected in each sample compared to the total number of genes detected in the bulk sample. And so here, you know, sensitivity can sometimes be thought of as detection efficiency, or how many genes can you find in a specific sample. And so you can see that, there's a lot of variability in the amount of RNA or the amount of genes that are detected in each of the single cells. An average cell has about 66% of the genes that are detected in the bulk sample. And here are the technical replicates I was telling you about. So there's 40 picograms, 8 picograms, and 2 picograms. And you can see that the technical replicates have a relatively stable total number of genes. But the important result here is that when I look at technical replicates that were performed in CHIP and compare the number of genes detected to the technical replicates that were performed in tube, I can consistently detect more genes in the CHIP format. So I have slightly higher sensitivity. So what I'm in this graph here, I'm binning genes by their mean expression. And I'm plotting their detection efficiency, which is the ratio of genes detected in that bin over the ratio of the number of genes detected in the bulk sample. So you can see here in the solid red line, even down at 1 RPKM, which is a relatively low expression, I can detect almost twice as many genes in the CHIP format as in the tube format. And so I'm also plotting in gray here all of the single cells. The detection efficiency curve. And so you can see that they sort of cluster around the 8 picogram curves. And this implies that 8 picograms is a relatively good estimate for the amount of RNA in a single cell, which kind of agrees with previous observations. So another thing that we did just to look at sensitivity is I took 10 of those 10 average cells, the 10 cells that are labeled here in red, and I subsampled their reads so that only 200,000 reads covered each cell. And then I pulled those aligned reads back into one large population. And so now I have 10 cells covered at 200,000 reads each. And I compared that to the bulk transcriptome that was then subsampled back down to 2 million reads. And so the point here is that for the same amount of reads, essentially for the same amount of money, I can detect almost about 82% of the total genes that are detected in the bulk sample with fairly good correlation to the bulk transcriptome. But I can also get 10 single cell measurements. And so the idea is that as we get more and more sensitive RNA sequencing protocols, we'll be able to sequence less and less deeply and get a lot of information about the biological sample that we're looking at. So now I wanted to look at the precision of the technique, and precision is sort of analogous to reproducibility. And so, you know, a lot of times people are making single cell measurements, they're very interested in looking at the variation, the biological variation in, say, the expression of a specific gene. And so you make many single cell measurements, let's say you make many measurements of the expression of a gene, and you'll usually see some variation, some standard deviation in the distribution of measurements. However, if you were to make many measurements of the same single cell, you still intrinsically see some variation in your measurement, and this comes from the innate noise, the technical noise in your measurement technique. And so it's very important to characterize this noise, because if that noise is larger than the real biological variation, then you'll be inaccurately making conclusions about the biological variation in the sample. And so we used the technical replicas that I told you about to sort of characterize this systematic variation in the technique. So I did this two ways. First, I compared four different technical replicates, two that were prepared in a tube format and two that were prepared in a chip format. And in these correlation plots, essentially each one of these dots represents a gene. And I'm plotting the expression of that gene in one replicate to the expression of that gene in the other replicate. And so if the two replicates were exactly the same, you'd see a solid diagonal line through the middle. And in reality, deviation from this line indicates the technical noise in the measurement. And so you can see that we have a little bit higher reproducibility in the chip format than in the tube format. And this makes sense because we're using these photolithographically defined volumes. So we're essentially removing all pipette error from the experiment. And also because we're doing the experiments in parallel using this sort of semi-automated procedure, you can kind of minimize the subtle variation that's due to human experimentation. So we have slightly higher precision. But I also wanted to characterize what that noise actually is because of the arguments I made in the previous slide. And so here, I'm plotting the coefficient of variation, which is the mean normalized standard deviation of each gene across the whole set of technical replicates. And I'm plotting that value against the mean expression of that gene. And so again, each dot is a gene. And you can see that genes that are expressed at a high value or a high level show relatively low variation in their measurement. And the inverse for genes that are expressed at a low value. And also globally, in experiments where there's more RNA, so namely in a 40 picogram experiment, you sort of have a global suppression of noise. And this makes sense. This sort of follows Poisson statistics. And in fact, you can fit this curve here to a Poisson distribution. And this curve essentially gives us our technical noise floor, or the limit of detection of biological variability. Because I told you that 8 picograms is a good estimate for the amount of RNA in a single cell, I'm using the 8 picogram noise curve to model the noise in my single cell measurements. And so here I'm plotting that same 8 picogram noise curve in front, and then behind in black and blue, I'm plotting the coefficient of variation across 44 biological replicates, or 44 mouse embryonic stem cells. And so each one of these genes across the 44 stem cells does experience true biological variation, but you only can see that variation when it's larger than the technical noise. And so what I've done here is I've selected genes that show a coefficient of variation that's 3 standard deviations above the mean from the 8 picogram sample, and I've labeled those in blue, and those genes we call sort of detectably biologically variable. So when you go in and look at those genes at a single gene level, these are a histogram of gene expression across all the different cells, and you can see that a lot of cells express some of these genes at relatively high levels, and there's a whole population of cells for these genes that don't express a gene at all. And so this is a useful way of pulling out real biological variation. And you can use the same approach to find genes that distinguish between different kinds of cells. And so here, I pooled a homogeneous group of 12 stem cells together and plotted the coefficient of variation in their genes and compared that to a mixed population of stem cells and fibroblasts, which I've labeled in blue and red. And so the idea here is the genes in the mixed population, which lies 3 standard deviations above the homogeneous population curve, which I've labeled here in blue, are genes that sort of strongly contribute to the variation between stem cells and fibroblasts. And so when you use these genes and plug them back into unsupervised hierarchical clustering, you can see that you can accurately group the cells back into their true biological group. And so, you know, all the stem cells group and the fibroblast group. And the cool thing about this result is you can also do this separation using long non-coding RNA. And so the idea is that, you know, you can group cells together with genes that aren't necessarily even coding genes. Okay, so in summary of this first section, the microfluidic single-cell RNA-seq platform provides improved sensitivity, improved precision, and also because I'm processing the cells in parallel, I can save a little bit of time and money in the protocol. Okay, so I at the beginning I showed you this sort of classical picture of a cartoon of a bright field microscope, but now because of an immense evolution in microscopy, improvements in optics and sophisticated labeling techniques, as well as image processing software, allows us to extract quantitative data from on the single cell level about the morphology of different cells. And so, for the last couple of years in Beijing, I've been really interested in using nonlinear label-free optical microscopy to quantify lipid droplet formation in adipocytes. So I'll talk to you a little bit about this work now. But first I want to tell you about the microscopy technique we use. So a group of grad students and I in the Huang lab built a stimulated Raman scattering microscope. And stimulated Raman scattering is a nonlinear optical process which can excite sort of the fundamental vibrational modes in chemical bonds. And it's very similar, if you know, to spontaneous Raman spectroscopy. So the idea is that in stimulated Raman scattering, is if you use 2 incident photons and you tune the energy of those photons such that the difference between those 2 photons' energy matches the fundamental vibrational energy in a particular bond. Let's say in this case, we're looking at CH stretching in a CH2 molecule. Then this pump and the Stokes photon can actively drive resonance in this vibrational mode. And through the energy transfer process, through this virtual state, a single photon in for example, the pump frequency will be converted into the frequency of the Stokes frequency, and so in this stimulated Raman scattering process, you can measure this interaction by looking at a loss of intensity in the pump line, or by looking at a gain of intensity in the Stokes line. And this process is similar also to coherent anti-Stokes Raman scattering, in which an anti-Stokes photon is also generated at a longer wavelength. And so instead of looking at that, we're actually looking at the change in that line. And so stimulated Raman scattering microscopy allows us to take these nice chemically specific images. So here is what you're looking at is a HeLa cell that has absorbed fatty acid from the extracellular environment and stored a fatty acid into these lipid droplets. And so I'm focusing in on the CH2 stretching mode and exciting just those bonds in this cell. So I'm able to get a quantitative, three-dimensional reconstruction of a single cell. So what I wanted to do first before studying the adipocyte lipid regulation was to first see if I could make a microfluidic platform in order to systematically study lipid droplet metabolism at the single cell level. And so I wanted to use sort of a well-characterized system by which oleic acid or fatty acid in general is taken up by cells in culture at a rate that's proportional to the concentration of the extracellular fatty acid. So the idea is that as you put more oleic acid into the cell culture dish, there's more and more internalized lipid droplets after some incubation time. And so, you know, there's different sort of mechanisms that contribute to this process. There's a diffusive component, and there's also an active metabolic component. So we wanted to see if we could quantify some of this system in a microfluidic platform. So I first designed this microfluidic device. It's essentially an array of cell culture chambers in order to systematically look at this lipid transfer process. This is what the device looks like. The red channels are the control channels here, and the blue channels are the incubation chambers. And it's essentially an arrayed cell culture platform in which this fundamental element here is the repeated element. And so on one side, there's a cell incubation chamber. And on the other side, there's a reagent reservoir. So this is where I store oleic acid. And these two chambers are separated by this microfluidic valve. So when a microfluidic valve is opened, the oleic acid can diffuse into the incubation chamber, and the final concentration is equal to half of the original concentration. So if I change the volume of the reservoir, then I can change the final equilibrium concentration. And so by iterating this motif, I can create a systematic gradient of oleic acid across these cell culture chambers. So I've taken this element and then replicated it in a microfluidic array so that I can make replicate measurements on the same titration. And the idea here is when you want to make single cell measurements, it's important to gather large numbers of measurements so you can gather accurate statistics. And so here's the platform again using food coloring instead of oleic acid, so you can see the gradient. And so we just flow in HeLa cells here, let them incubate in an incubator. And then after 3 to 6 hours, image the lipid droplet content using stimulated Raman scattering. So the optical setup is essentially consists of putting the microfluidic device onto the stimulated Raman microscope. here's a quick schematic of the microscope. So we used two co-aligned picosecond pulse lasers that are tunable. And we direct those lasers into a scanning microscope, so that we can scan across the biological sample. Here you can see I put the microfluidic device on the microscope stage. But because we're looking at a very minute change of intensity of one of the beams, in this case of the pump beam, we have to use a modulation and demodulation scheme in order to pick up on that signal. And so before entering into the microscope, I chop the Stokes beam at 10 megahertz and then collect both of the transmitted beams with a condenser, but then filter out the modulated Stokes beam. And so the result is a transmitted pump beam which has the stimulated Raman loss, which is modulated at the original frequency. And so a lock-in amplifier can then be used to pick up on that fundamental frequency and send a differential signal in to the computer for image reconstruction. So this is how I make that three-dimensional image of the of the HeLa cell. And so in doing this, I can sort of systematically probe the lipid content across this titration of oleic acid. So this is sort of a qualitative result. You can see as I add more oleic acid, I'm seeing more brighter lipid droplets. But what I wanted to do is see if I could go in there using image processing and extract quantitative information so that we can make some more accurate conclusions about what's going on. And so in these experiments, I actually took two images for each field of view. I took a lipid image where I focused in on the CH2 stretching, and then I looked at the sort of a line in general protein by looking at CH3. And so in this way, I could create, this is sort of the cytoplasmic boundary for each cell. And by using this image, I could create a cell mask quite easily because the boundary is pretty clearly defined. And in doing so, I could assign each lipid droplet to a specific cell and allow me to extract quantitative information on a single cell level. And so in this way, I can measure number of lipid droplets per cell, the total lipid content, and so forth. So just as a demonstration, you can see that we do have increased, what I'm plotting here is the total lipid per cell. So I'm adding all the lipids together. And the other important thing about stimulated Raman scattering is that the signal is linearly proportional to the number of molecules in the confocal volume, into the focal volume. And so essentially that means that it's quantitative, so that the intensity is a measurement of the number of bonds. And so you can see that as I add oleic acid to the cell culture chamber, you have this increase in total lipid per cell, which is to be expected. But we sort of noticed that it kind of plateaus after a certain critical concentration. So that means it's not completely diffusive, that there's some machinery in the cell that can modulate the amount of uptake of lipids. And also because we're looking at individual lipids, we can get information about the distribution of lipid size and so forth for each cell. And also what I did recently is I put multiple cell types on one chip because I have this replicate configuration. You can inject different kinds of cells and sort of screen across cell lines. And so a grad student in the lab now has taken this platform and she's using it to screen small molecules to see how it affects lipid metabolism in different cells. And this is an ongoing project in the lab after we've sort of demonstrated the platform. But what I'm particularly interested in is lipid droplet formation and regulation during adipogenesis. And adipogenesis is the process by which stem cells differentiate into adipocytes or fat cells. And adipocytes are a very important cell in our body. Here's a stimulated Raman scattering image of one. These are big lipid droplets, again looking at the CH2 stretching. And adipocytes, you know, store about 80% of the lipids in our body, and they represent a sort of primary energy storage machinery. And disruption in the adipogenic program can lead to pathologies like type 2 diabetes, obesity, and heart disease. And so it's, you know, really important to understand the gene expression network that are involved during adipogenesis. And so if you look at many images of single adipocytes, one of the first things you notice is this drastic variation in the lipid droplet content. All of these adipocytes have been differentiated from 3T3L1 cell, which is a mouse fibroblast line with which you can direct differentiation into adipocytes. It takes about a week. You add insulin and a cocktail of drugs. So I've harvested all these adipocytes from the same stage of differentiation. And this is a regular observation. You see that each cell has a lot of variability in the number and the size of lipid droplets. And so one of the sort of the questions you might ask is, does this variation come from random fluctuations in the physical and chemical environment? Or does this indicate, you know, real biological variation in the machinery that's involved in forming and regulating lipid droplets? And this observation was one of the observations that made me interested in looking at the gene expression profile of these of adipocytes on a single cell level. So to do that, I wanted to perform imaging and an RNA sequencing on that original chip that I showed you. And so here's an overview of the original single-cell RNA-seq chip. Again, the blue lines are the control valves, and the dark purple lines are the flow channels where I put the single cells and the biological reagents. This chip has 8 in parallel. The current chip has 10. And so if we zoom in here, this long central flow line is where I inject a suspension of single adipocytes. And so this microfluidic pump, which is essentially 3 valves that are lined up that can be actuated in a certain sequence, allow me to pump single cells through the injection chamber into this trapping chamber where I can actively trap the cells using the trap. And so after the cells are trapped, I use the stimulated Raman scattering imaging to create this, you know, three-dimensional profile, the lipid droplet distribution. After imaging, I sort the cell into the sorting chamber where it waits while I image, trap and image the other 9 cells. And then after that process, in parallel, we lyse the cell and perform all the cDNA preparation. And so we have a direct connection between that lipid droplet distribution from the image and then the gene expression profile. And so looking at a subset of our data, there's a couple things that you see immediately. First of all, in any suspension of single adipocytes, there's a handful of cells that never underwent differentiation, and so they're readily identifiable by the image and their lack of lipids. And it turns out that these cells are also very easy to distinguish using their gene expression. And so plugging the gene expression data into this unsupervised hierarchical clustering algorithm, you can see that we can sort of very consistently group the undifferentiated 3T3 cells into this group because of their gene expression. And also if you use principal component analysis, the undifferentiated and differentiated adipocytes can be easily distinguished along the first principal component. The other thing that you see is there's this really strong variation in gene expression even among cells in the same sort of differentiated group. And so the question is, how can I use the lipid droplet image to inform this biological variation. And so to begin to do this, I first have been developing some image processing software that allowed me, again, to find, to take this lipid image and then find parameters like the position, size, and number of lipid droplets in each cell. So this gives me sort of a lipid droplet distribution for every cell, which is kind of like a fingerprint for the adipocyte, and then characterize different parameters of the morphology of that adipocyte. So then the other thing that we know is that in vivo, in adipose tissue, functional mature adipocytes exhibit this phenotype where they have one large lipid droplet. And presumably this is maybe more efficient for lipid storage or to protect the cell from the lipids internally. And so the working hypothesis is that the heterogeneity comes from the fact that not all of the cells in a given petri dish are undergoing differentiation in a synchronous manner. And so maybe, you know, all of the cells in one stage are headed towards this final phenotype, but they're just at different time points. And so maybe I can use a lipid droplet image and sort of quantify the lipid droplet distribution in a way that intuitively would lead towards this single droplet state, and then use the image to align the cells up into this sort of pseudo-temporal timeline so that I can more accurately understand the dynamics of gene expression during adipogenesis. So this is one of the approaches I'm taking. The other work that I'm doing is just trying to arbitrarily correlate different parameters of the lipid droplet distribution with gene expression. So essentially plugging in some of these parameters into the clustering algorithms and seeing if we can group stuff by, you know, different aspects of their lipid components. So that's the work that I'm currently doing, but this investigation naturally leads to another question, which is the morphology the cause or effect of gene expression? Is there some sort of, can you tease out the causal relationship between these two? It's kind of a chicken or the egg question, and in certain cases, likely it's both, right, depending on what you're looking at. But there's a couple different ways that I'm imagining going through asking or approaching these questions. And so one would be doing something like actively perturbing the morphology of a cell using a chemical or a physical stimulus, and then measuring the gene expression response. And so this would be a very direct way of looking at some of the causal relationships between morphology and gene expression. The other thing that you can imagine doing is monitoring using imaging some molecular machinery that's known to have regulatory function. And so if you could take an image of let's say, you know, position of transcription factors or so forth, and then measure gene expression for that same cell, you could begin to infer causal relationships. And so this is what I like to do with this technology, with looking at neurons. And so the idea is to use, in one case, look at the transcriptional response in neurodegeneration. So essentially use amyloid fibrils as the perturbation and see how what the gene expression response is to that sort of perturbation. In another case, try to understand how genome organization is related to gene expression regulation at the single cell level. So just to kind of lead into those ideas, in the first idea, I could expose cells in culture to amyloid fibrils and use the single cell imaging to differentiate between binding of the amyloid fibrils to the cell surface and then internalization. What happens is, if you expose cells in culture, so let's say Huntington fibrils or Parkinson's fibrils, the fibrils will bind to the surface and over some time scale become internalized, and then the cell will die. And all these time scales have been relatively well defined in different in vitro measurements in the past, but again, maybe don't happen synchronously in a cell culture dish. And so you could use imaging to sort of decouple these processes from the gene expression response. In another example, you could use maybe CRISPR imaging to label specific loci within a genome in live cells, and then use fluorescent imaging to measure the position of various genomic loci, and then use the microfluidic platform to measure gene expression on the single cell level to make direct connections between genome organization and gene expression. So with that, I hope I've convinced you that this sort of generic platform is useful in a lot of different circumstances, but the main idea is that by looking at the image and the gene expression of the same cell, we can infer a lot of quantitative relationships between morphology and gene expression. So with that, I'd like to acknowledge my advisor, Dr. Yanni Huang, who runs the lab at BioPIC. Qian Yan is a co-author of mine on the single-cell RNA-seq paper. He constructed a lot of the original pipeline for data analysis. And then some other students in the lab have been very helpful, you know, with cell culture and imaging and so forth. Chun right now is performing the new screening experiments on the cell culture platform. And then Dr. Fuchou Tong, our collaborator and neighbor, has been very, very helpful with the initial RNA-seq protocol stuff. He's an expert in his lab. And then Dr. Sunny Xie from Harvard is the director of our institute. And he's not only secured a lot of resources for the lab in China, but helped us with the original SRS system, because he was one of the early developers of SRS in 2008. So I'd like to thank you guys very much for your attention.
Please. Can you tell us a little bit more about the stimulated Raman? What else can one, so obviously exciting because you can image without
labels. That's right.
What else
can you look at?
Can one use to image? You obviously focused on fatty acids.
Yeah, so the cross section for stimulated Raman scattering is a lot larger than for spontaneous Raman. So it's faster than saying mapping using spontaneous Raman, but it's still not as sensitive as fluorescence. One of the reasons why I'm looking at lipids is because lipids have a very, very strong signal, because you know they're highly densely packed in a droplet form, and there's many CH2 bonds along the chain of the fatty acids. Another problem with Raman is that while lipids have this very distinct peak that's for the CH2 peak that's really outside of the mess. And a lot of proteins look very similar according to Raman because they have a lot of the same molecular bonds. So different proteins have different peaks, and the way that you have to disassociate, the way that you can distinguish proteins is by looking at multiple lines and then deconvoluting the signal. So there's a lot of really interesting work that's going on in Sunny's lab and some other Raman labs. Where they can do sort of multiplex Raman using like a broadband femtosecond laser, then to deconvolve many different bonds in one image, they can the multicolor image. When you're looking at just one line, which is better for faster imaging, there's a couple other tricks that you can use if you want to look at proteins that maybe don't have as distinct of a Raman signature. And so one thing that we've been doing in the lab is using like deuterated molecules as a way of identifying, let's say, a specific like water uptake. We use like heavy water uptake in cells, or using alkyne tags on certain labels. So you have to use more tricks than you otherwise would with fluorescence because of the specificity. But the result is you get these nice three-dimensional images.
Just partly a follow-up from what Boris said. So, in cells that don't have big fat droplets, for example, can you image membranes? Because there's plenty of methylenes in membranes, or So
there's been some really nice experiments looking at sort of membrane fusion. The signal's not as strong, and with the original coherent anti-Stokes Raman scattering, one of the issues was there's just non-resonant background, so you have a little bit of non-specificity. With SRS, you don't have that, but you have to do if the image for a long time using pretty powerful lasers. So one problem would be like disrupting the membrane during the imaging. But there have been some nice experiments showing a membrane imaging.
So and I was also wondering, when you were comparing bulk analysis of RNAs versus the single cell analysis, there were some genes that were detected only in the single cell analysis.
Yeah.
Is that noise or is that significant?
Both. Some of it's noise, some of it's just mapping errors and let me go back to that graph really quick. The interesting thing about that measurement specifically, however, is, let's see, all the way back here. Talking right here, right?
Yeah.
RPKM is like a relative measurement, and so, one of the issues with the single cell measurement is you have to amplify all of the RNA first, or the cDNA first, before you measure it. And so the result is a lot of bias. So transcripts that are more abundant, sort of get a head start with exponential amplification, then transcripts are less abundant. And so there's a high possibility that when you're doing that, you know, transcripts that have a very low abundance can get missed or sort of washed out. And so when you're looking at a bulk experiment where you have, you know, 10,000 different genes, you can imagine that in that experiment or in many experiments, the low copy number transcripts don't ever get seen. Then if they exist in a single cell, but you reduce the total amount of molecules, there's a higher chance that they'll get amplified. And so in, for some of these genes that were not detected in bulk, we think they are actually, you know, sort of rare expressed or low expressed transcripts that you wouldn't be able to detect in the bulk.
So in some ways, it almost has more sensitivity for at least some.
Yeah, and there's an extension of that. I mean, one thing you could also do, then you could begin to, you could split up, you could partition a single cell into many different compartments, and then you're sort of increasing the effective concentration of those low copy number transcripts. That would be a way of increasing sensitivity. So that's one of the reasons why I think this is an interesting direction to go in, because again, you know, if you make many measurements on single cells, you might be able to even make a better representation as we get better sensitivity than the bulk measurement.
And then the extreme variation you saw with some genes, I can't remember which, I think they were on embryonic stem cells, where you got some that were showing no expression at all, some cells were showing no expression. Did you, were those cells in any way normalized for cell cycle expression?
We didn't normalize for cell cycle. That's a really good point. And that's where you get a lot of variation from. And now people are doing better is, you know, just looking at genes marked to cell cycle and then going in and making sure that variation is not, I mean, I guess it depends on what your question is, because that is also real.
Zeros, yeah, I mean.
Yeah, some of those are also like pluripotency related genes that, you know, maybe the cell started to differentiate. In the fibroblast, we saw a lot of variation that came from, the fact that maybe there are different tissues, you know, because we take these embryonic fibroblasts, our collaborator extracts them from the embryo, and so, you know, these could actually be indicative of like sort of different cell types that are all sort of in the fibroblast line.
So if I understood correctly, the detectable replicates are like you match a bunch of cells together and then you do the RNA-seq on that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, mash up a bunch of cells together and then dilute down to like, you know, 40 picograms, you know, quantify the total, this is total RNA. So quantify and then dilute down to 40 picograms or 8 picograms and then put the RNA in actually, let's see, what I'll do is I'll just, instead of putting the cell in, I'll just fill this whole chamber with you know, RNA. And then sort of at a concentration such that when I multiply it by this volume, I get the amount that I want. And then I perform the experiment with that, you know, as if there was a cell there, but instead it's just, you know, cell-free RNA.
Okay, so I guess I'm wondering, it seems like the technical replicate will at least miss variation due to number one cell lysis. And then depending on when you, you know, what are the steps you're doing, when you might miss some of the ones?
Yeah. So, you know, we hope in a good experiment the cell is completely lysed and we catch every transcript that's, you know, in there. I do sometimes see, so what I didn't show you is I do a little bit of trimming of the data first, but, you know, I have a condition by which I take cells. Like sometimes the cells, there's really like very low mapping, so I just consider them to be, you know, dead cells or disrupted cells, and it's possible that a cell doesn't lyse as well as we thought. So ideally, you know, every cell lyses completely and we catch all of the RNA, but, you know, it's possible that some cells there was some other problem with that we couldn't detect with the image. So that's technical variation in lysis, right? The ability to get sort of complete penetrance of lysis, but we try to engineer it so that doesn't happen so often. Sort of trim out those anomalies. Do you have a question?
Yeah. To probe the same cell, like how much manipulation can you do before the cell lysis and all these other, because you don't want the cell to
stress.
So how much time has
to pass? It takes me, each one of these images takes about 2 minutes to scan across the whole cell. And then, you know, depending on the day and the mood of the chip, you know, it might take me longer or shorter to catch a cell. Sometimes there's two cells, and I want to watch. You know, the thing that's good about the active catching is that I can decide if I want that cell or not. So if I catch a cell and it looks unhealthy for some reason, I can just flush it out and continue going. But that process can take it up to an hour. And so you're absolutely right. You know, by measuring the system, you perturb it. And so all of these cells are sitting at room temperature. I do have a hot plate or a sort of a temperature-controlled environment, but you can say all these cells are undergoing non-ideal conditions for about an hour. And I mean, I love to talk with people that are, you know, experts in cell culture about this, but the idea is that if they all experience that trauma, then we can still detect differential expression, maybe tease out some of the differences in what we're looking at. So in the cell culture platform, you know, right now I'm working on a way of coupling the two chips together, and so the idea would be that you'd have to do less in between. I mean, any single cell measurement, you have to trypsinate the cells, spin them down, clean them, and so there's always a little bit of stuff you have to do to the cell before you can measure it. But hopefully we're minimizing that.
So in your experience, how many cells is necessary for like accurate differentiation between biological variation and technical?
So one rule of thumb that people use is if you're looking at, so if it depends on the question you're asking. If I'm looking at one cell type. So to characterize the variation in a single cell type, you know, people say 50 to 100 cells to get the complete standard deviation. But if you're looking at a complex tissue like a brain sample, where you don't even know necessarily how many cell types you have, then, you know, current experiments are up to 1,000 and 10,000 cells to really get the complexity. So for the adipocyte stuff, I'm like at 50 to 100, just looking at the biological variation of a single type of cell. Yeah.
So for the studies where you were looking at the lipid droplet morphology and you track that morphology, and it seemed like you were mostly looking at differences in gene expression to relate that. But I would think that lipid droplet behavior might have a phase behavior that's totally different than sort of unrelated
yeah.
to the gene expression,
yeah.
which is just
yeah.
the fact that it's a metastable system.
Completely.
And evolution. So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the physics?
Well, that's a great question. So when I was studying protein crystal growth, Steve, we characterized the Oswalt ripening of different clusters of protein, and the idea is that it's a completely physical phenomenon by which, you know, there's, you know, larger clusters are more stable than smaller clusters, and so because of surface tension and energy considerations, you have this coalescence, and you'll see that if you mix up oil emulsions and water, they'll tend to form one big lipid droplet, you know, at the end. And so that's exactly the question I'm trying to tease out. How much of that heterogeneity is just purely physical? And how much of it is actually active machinery? And so, you know, there's been a ton of studies about the regulatory pathways and adipogenesis, but it's still not clear how many, like, what every protein that's involved in making sure that there's, you know, a certain number of lipid droplets, or, like, what's the computational, you know, system that's actually at play there, or is it just taking advantage of sort of chemical, physical phenomena? So that's exactly what I'm curious about.
Can I follow up on that? Like
yeah.
How is your single cell expression study, which gives you correlations, how's that going to inform whether these are two parallel processes
yeah.
versus causal?
So like what I'm working with right now is we've definitely found genes that correlate on some level with lipid droplet content. And surely, like, the cells that have one big lipid droplet have to go through some different processes to deal with that, just the volume constraints in other cells. But the idea is that it kind of has to do with how you quantify the lipid droplet distribution. So what parameters in that distribution are important? Is it number, or is it, you know, like, number normalized to cell size, or is it average size? Some of these parameters are probably don't correlate with gene expression. And the reason is likely because it's not an active process, you know, whereas other numbers might, like the total number of lipid in a cell strongly correlates with some of the larger activators for adipogenesis, like PPAR gamma and beta. And so there's definitely some that are, you know, directly related to gene expression, and there are definitely some parameters that are probably not. And so I'm trying to, like, look in the middle and see if I can tease out some of the more specific fine structure of that relationship. Any more questions? Great. Thank you guys very much.